I'm sorry, Jeecha says. He bends and snaps the man's neck, even as he's drawing breath to ask, for what? Then Jeecha rises. His hands are shaking again. But he turns and extends one of them. Nasun takes it. They walk back to the wagon and resume their journey south. The season will always return. Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, verse 1. 6. You commit to the cause. A what? Asks Tonki, squinting at you through a curtain of hair. You've just come into the apartment after spending part of the day helping one of the work shifts fletch and repair crossbow bolts for the hunter's use. Since you're not part of any particular use cast, you've been helping out with each of them in turn a little every day. This was on Yika's advice, though Yika's skeptical about your newfound determination to try to fit into the comm. She likes that you're trying, at least. Another suggestion was for you to encourage Tonki to do the same, since thus far Tonki's done nothing but eat and sleep and bathe on the comm's generosity. Granted, a certain amount of the lattermost has been necessary for the sake of comm socialization. At the moment, Tonki is kneeling over a basin of water in a room, hacking at her hair with a knife to chop out the matted bits. You're keeping well back because the room smells of mildew and body odor, and because you think you see something moving in the water along with her shed hair. Tonki may have needed to wear filth as part of her calmless disguise, but that doesn't mean it wasn't actual filth. A moon, you say. It's a strange word, brief and round. You're not sure how much to stretch out the ooh sound in the middle. What else had Alabaster said? A satellite. He said a geomest would know. She frowns more while sawing at a particularly stubborn Hank. Well, I don't know what he's talking about. Never heard of a moon. The obelisks are my area of expertise, remember? Then she blinks and pauses, letting the half-hacked Hank dangle. Although, technically, the obelisks themselves are satellites. What? Well, satellite just means an object whose motion and position are dependent on another. The object that controls everything is called a primary. The dependent object is its satellite, see? She shrugs. It's something astronomists talk about when you can get any sense out of them. Orbital mechanics. She rolls her eyes. What? Gibberish. Plate tectonics for the sky. You stare, disbelieving, and she waves a hand. Anyway, I told you how the obelisks followed you to Terimo. Where you go, they go. That makes them satellites to your primary. You shudder, not liking the thought that comes into your head of thin, invisible tethers anchoring you to the amethyst, the nearer topaz, and now the distant onyx whose dark presence is growing in your mind. And, oddly, you also think of the fulcrum, of the tethers that bound you to it, even when you had the apparent freedom to leave it and travel. You always came back, though, or the fulcrum would have come after you in the form of the guardians. Chains, you say softly. No, no, Tonki says distractedly. She's working on the Hank again and having real trouble with it. Her knife has gone blunt. You leave for a moment and go into the room that you share with Hoa, fetching the whetstone from your pack. She blinks when you offer it to her, then nods thanks and starts sharpening the knife. If there was a chain between you and an obelisk, it would be following you because you're making it follow you. Force, not gravity. I mean, if you could make an obelisk do what you wanted. You let out a little breath of amusement at this. But a satellite reacts to you, regardless of whether you try to make it react. It's drawn to your presence and the weight you exert upon the universe. It lingers around you because it can't help itself. She waves a wet hand distractedly, while you stare again. Not to ascribe motivations and intentions to the obelisks, of course. That would be silly. You crouch against the far wall of the room to consider this while she resumes work. As the remainder of her hair begins to loosen, you recognize it at last because it's curly and dark like your own, instead of ash blow and gray. A little looser in the curl, maybe, mid-ladder hair. Another mark against her in the eyes of her family, probably. And given the bog-standard, sun-zed look of her otherwise, she's a bit on the short and pear-shaped side. But that's what comes of the Humanescent families not using breeders to improve themselves. It's something you would have remembered about her from that long-ago visit she made to the Fulcrum. You don't think Alabaster was talking about the obelisks when he mentioned this moon thing. Still, you said that thing we found in the Fulcrum, that socket, was where they built the obelisks. It's immediately clear you're back on ground that Tonki is actually interested in. She sets the knife down and leans forward, her face excited through the dangling, uneven remainder of her hair. Mm-hmm. Maybe not all of them. The dimensions of every obelisk recorded have been slightly different, so only some, or maybe even just one, would have fit in that socket. Or maybe the socket changed every time they put one in there, adapting itself to the obelisk. How do you know they put them in there? Maybe they first grew there, then were faceted, or mined, and taken away later. This makes Tonki look thoughtful. You feel obliquely proud to have considered something she hasn't. And they who? She blinks, then sits back, her excitement visibly fading. Finally, she says, supposedly, the Humanescent leadership is descended from the people who saved the world after the Shattering Season. We have texts passed down from that time, secrets that each family is charged with keeping, and which were supposed to be shown upon earning our use and calm names. She scowls. My family didn't, because they were already thinking about disowning me. So I broke into the vault and took my birthright. You nod, because that sounds like the Beanoff you remember. You're skeptical about the family secret, though. Humanus didn't exist before Sansa. And Sansa's only the latest of the countless civilizations that must have come and gone over the seasons. The leadership legends have the air of a myth, concocted to justify their place in society. Tonki continues. In the vault, I found all sorts of things. Maps, strange writing in a language like none I've ever seen. Objects that didn't make sense. Like one tiny, perfectly round yellow stone, about an inch in circumference. Someone had put it in a glass case, sealed and plastered with warnings not to touch. Apparently the thing had a reputation for punching holes in people. You wince. So either there's some truth to the family stories, or amazingly, being rich and powerful makes it easy to assemble quite the collection of valuable ancient objects. Or both. She notices your expression and looks amused. Yeah, probably not both. It's not stone lore anyway, just words. Soft knowledge. I need it to harden it. That sounds like Tonki. So you snuck into the Fulcrum to try to find the socket, because somehow this proves some rusty old story your family passed down? It was on one of the maps I found. Tonki shrugs. If there was truth to part of the story about there being a socket in Humanus, deliberately hidden away by the city's founders, then that did suggest there might be truth to the rest, yes. Setting the knife aside, Tonki shifts to get comfortable, idly brushing the shed hairs into a pile with one hand. Her hair is painfully short and uneven now, and you really want to take the scissors from her and shape it. You'll wait till she's given it another wash first, though. There is truth to other parts of the stories, too, Tonki says. I mean, a lot of the stories are rust and mellow smoke. I don't want to pretend otherwise. But I learned at 7th that the obelisks go as far back as history goes and then some. We have evidence of seasons from 10, 15, even 20,000 years ago, and the obelisks are older. It's possible that they even predate the shattering. The first season, and the one that nearly killed the world. Only lorists speak of it, and the Seventh University has disavowed most of their tales. Out of contrariness, you say, maybe there wasn't a shattering. Maybe there have always been fifth seasons. Maybe. Tonki shrugs, either not noticing your attempt to be obnoxious or not caring. Probably the latter. Mentioning the shattering was a great way to set off a 5-hour argument in the colloquium. Stupid old farts. She smiles to herself, remembering, and then abruptly sobers. You understand at once. D-Bars, the city that housed Seventh, is in the Equatorials, only a little west of Eumenes. I don't believe it, though, Tonki says, when she's had a moment to recover, that we've always had seasons. Why not? Because of us. She grins. Life, I mean. It's not different enough. What? Tonki leans forward. She's not quite as excited as she gets about obelisks, but it's clear that just about any long-hidden knowledge sets her off. For a moment, in the gleam of her open, cheeky face, you see Beanoff. Then she speaks and becomes Tonki the Geomast again. All things change during a season, yes? But not enough. Think of it this way. Everything that grows or walks on land can breathe the world's air, eat its food, survive its usual shifts in temperature. We don't have to change to do that. We are precisely the way we need to be, because that's how the world works, right? Maybe people are the worst of the lot. Maybe we have to use our hands to make coats instead of just growing fur. But we can make coats. We're built for that, with clever hands that can sew and brains that can figure out how to hunt or grow animals for fur. But we aren't built to filter ash out of our lungs before it turns into cement. Some animals are. Tonki gives you an ugly look. Stop interrupting. It's rude. You sigh and gesture for her to go on, and she nods, mollified. Now, yes, some animals grow lung filters during a season, or start breathing water and move into the ocean where it's safer, or bury themselves and hibernate or whatever. We've figured out how to build not just coats, but store caches and walls and stone lore. But these are afterthoughts. She gestures wildly, groping for the words. Like, when a cartwheel blows a spoke and you're halfway between comms, you improvise, see? You put a stick or even a bar of metal into the space where the broken spoke was, just to keep the wheel strong enough to last until you can reach a wheelwright. That's what's happening when Kakuza suddenly develop a taste for meat during a season. Why don't they just eat meat all the time? Why haven't they always eaten meat? Because they were originally built for something else. They're still better at eating something else. And eating meat during seasons is a slapdash last-minute fix nature threw in to keep Kirkusa from going extinct. That's... You're a little odd. It sounds crazy, but it feels right somehow. You can't think of any holes to poke in the theory, and you're not sure you want to. Tonki's not someone you mean to go toe-to-toe with in a battle of logic. Tonki nods. That's why I can't stop thinking about the obelisks. People built them, which means that as a species, we're at least as old as they are. That's a lot of time to break things, start over, and break them again. Or if the leadership stories are true, maybe it's enough time to put a fix in place. Something to tide us over, till the real repairs can be made. You frown to yourself. Wait. The Eumenesian leadership thinks the obelisks, leftover dead civ junk, are the fix? Basically. The stories say the obelisks held the world together when it would have come apart. And they imply there might someday be a way to end the seasons involving the obelisks. An end to all seasons. It's hard even to imagine. No need for runny sacks, no store caches. Comms could last forever, grow forever. Every city could become like Eumenes. It would be amazing, you murmur. Tonki glances sharply at you. Origins might be a kind of fix, too, you know, she says. And without the seasons, you'd no longer be needed. You frown back at her, not sure whether to be disquieted or comforted by that statement, until she starts finger-combing her remaining hair, and you realize you've run out of things to say. Hoa is gone. You're not sure where. You left him behind in the infirmary, staring down ruby hair, and when you returned to your apartment to try to get a few more hours' sleep, he was not beside you when you woke. His little bundle of rocks is still in your room next to your bed, so he must be planning to return soon. It's probably nothing. Still, after so many weeks, you feel oddly bereft without his strange, subtle presence. But perhaps this is just as well. You have a visit to make, and it might go easier without hostility. You walk to the infirmary again slowly, quietly. It's early evening, you think. Always hard to tell in Kastrima Under. But your body is still acclimated to the rhythms of the surface. For now, you trust in that. Some of the people out on the platforms and walkways stare as you pass. This comm spends plenty of time gossiping, clearly. That doesn't matter. All that does is whether Alabaster has had time enough to recover. You need to talk. There's no sign of the dead hunter's body from that morning. Everything's been cleaned up. Lerna's inside, in fresh clothing, and he glances at you as you come in. There's still a distance in his expression, you note, though he only meets your gaze for a moment before nodding and turning back to whatever he's doing with what look like surgical instruments. There's another man near him, pipetting something into a series of small glass vials. The man doesn't even look up. It's an infirmary. Anyone can come in. It's not until you're halfway down the infirmary's long central aisle, walking between the rows of cots, that you consciously notice the sound you've been hearing all along, a kind of hum. It seems monotonous at first, but as you concentrate on it, you detect multiple tones, harmonies, a subtle rhythm. Music? Music so alien, so difficult to parse, that you're not sure that word really applies. You can't figure out where it's coming from at first. Alabaster is still where you saw him that morning, on a pile of cushions and blankets on the floor. No telling why Lerna hasn't put him on a cot. There are flasks on a nightstand nearby, a roll of fresh bandages, some scissors, a pot of salve. A bedpan, thankfully unused since its last cleaning, though it still stinks near him. The music is coming from the Stone Eater, you realize in wonder, as you settle into a crouch before them. Antimony sits cross-legged near Alabaster's nest, utterly still, looking as though someone bothered to sculpt a woman sitting cross-legged with one hand upraised. Alabaster is asleep, though in an odd, nearly sitting up posture that you don't understand until you realize he's leaning back against Antimony's hand. Maybe that's the only way he can sleep comfortably. There are bandages on his arms today, shiny with salve. And he's not wearing a shirt, which helps you see that he's not as badly damaged as you first thought. There are no patches of stone on his chest or belly. And only a few small burns around his shoulders, most of those healed. But his torso is nearly skeletal, barely any muscle, ribs showing, belly almost concave. Also, his right arm is much shorter than it was that morning. You look up at Antimony. The music is coming from somewhere inside of her. Her black eyes are focused on him. They haven't moved with your arrival. It's peaceful, this strange music. And Alabaster looks comfortable. You haven't been taking care of him, you say, looking at his ribs and remembering countless evenings putting food in front of him, glaring while he wearily chewed it, conspiring with Inan to get him to eat at the group meals. He always ate more when he thought people were looking. If you were going to steal him from us, the least you could have done was feed him properly. Fatten him up before you ate him or something. The music continues. There is a very faint, stone-grating sound as her black cabochon eyes shift to you at last. They're such alien eyes, despite their superficial resemblance to human. You can see the dry, matte material that comprises the whites of her eyes. No veins, no spots, no off-white coloring that would indicate weariness or worry or anything else human. You can't even tell if there are pupils within the black of her irises. For all you know, she can't even see with them and uses her elbows to detect your presence and direction. You meet those eyes and realize, suddenly, that there's so little left in you which is capable of fear. You took him from us, and we couldn't do it alone. No, that is a lie of incompleteness. Inan, a feral, had no hope against guardians and a trained fulcrum origen. You, though? You're the one who fucked everything up. I couldn't do it alone. If Alabaster had been there... I hated you. Afterward, while I was wandering, I vowed to find a way to kill you. Put you in an obelisk like that other one. Bury you in the ocean, far enough out that no one will ever dig you up. She watches you and says nothing. You can't even read the catch of her breath because she doesn't breathe. But the music stops, dying into silence. That's a reaction, at least. This really is pointless. But then the silence looms louder. And you're still feeling kind of pissy, so you add, shame. The music was pretty. Later, lying in bed and considering the day's errors, you will think belatedly, I am as crazy now as Alabaster was back then. A moment later, Alabaster stirs, lifting his head and uttering a soft groan that throws your thoughts and your heart 10 years away before they circle back. He blinks at you in disorientation for a moment, and you realize he doesn't recognize you with your hair twice as long and your skin weathered and your clothes season-faded. Then he blinks again, and you take a deep breath, and you're both back in the here and now.
The onyx,
he says, his voice hoarse with sleep. Of course he knows.
Always biting off more than you can chew, Cyan.
You don't bother to correct him on the name. You said an obelisk.
I said the rusting topaz. But if you could call the onyx, I've underestimated your development.
His head cocks, his expression thoughtful.
What have you been doing these last few years to have refined your control so much?
You can't think of anything at first, and then you can. I had 2 children.
Keeping an origin child from destroying everything in its vicinity took a lot of your energy in those earliest years.
You learned to sleep with one eye open, your sesapine primed for the slightest twitch of infant fear or toddler pique, or worse, a local shake that might prompt either child to react. You quelled 12 disasters a night. He nods, and belatedly you remember waking up during the night in Mayov sometimes to find Alabaster blearily awake and watching Corundum. You remember teasing him, in fact, on his worrying, when Koru was clearly no threat to anyone.
Earth, burn it! You hate figuring out all this stuff after the fact. They left me with my mother for a few years after I was born, he says, almost to himself.
You'd guessed this already, given that he speaks a coaster language. How his fulcrum-bred mother had known it, though, is a mystery that will never be solved.
They took me away once I was old enough to be threatened effectively. But before that, she apparently prevented me from icing Eumenes a few times.
I don't think we're meant to be raised by stills.
He paused, his gaze distant.
I met her years later by chance. Didn't know her, though she somehow recognized me. I think she was on the senior advisory board. Topped out at 9 rings, if I recall.
He falls silent for a moment. Perhaps he's contemplating the fact that he killed his mother, too. Or maybe he's trying to remember something of her other than a hurried meeting between two strangers in a corridor. His focus sharpens abruptly, back to the present, and you.
I think you might be a 9-ringer now.
You can't help surprise and pleasure, though you cover both, with the appearance of nonchalance. I thought things like that didn't matter anymore.
They don't. I was careful to wipe out the fulcrum when I tore Eumenes apart. There are still buildings where the city was, perched on the edges of the mall, unless they've fallen in since. But the obsidian walls are rubble, and I made sure Maine went into the pit first.
There's a deep, vicious satisfaction in his voice.
He sounds like you a moment ago, as you imagined murdering stone eaters.
You glance at Antimony. She's gone back to watching Alabaster, her hand still supporting his back.
You could almost think of her as doing it out of devotion or kindness if you didn't know his hands and feet and forearm were in whatever passes for her stomach. I only mention rings, so you can have a point of reference.
Alabaster stirs, sitting up carefully, and then, as if he heard your thought, extending his stubby, stone-capped right arm.
Look inside this. Tell me what you see.
Are you going to tell me what's going on, Alabaster? But he doesn't answer, just looking at you, and you sigh.
All right. You look at his arm, which stops at the elbow now, and wonder what he means by look inside.
Then, unbidden, you remember a night when he willed poison out of the cells of his own body. But he had help for that.
You frown, impulsively glancing at the strangely shaped pink object behind him, the thing that looks like an overly long, big-handled knife, and which is actually somehow an obelisk. The spinal, he called it.
You glance at him. He must have seen you eye it. He doesn't move. Not a twitch of his burned and stone-crusted face, not a flicker of his non-existent eyelashes.
All right, then. Anything goes, as long as you do what he says. So you stare down at his arm. You don't want to chance the spinal. No telling what it will do. Instead, first you try letting your awareness go into the arm. This feels absurd. You've spent your life sassing layers of earth miles underground. To your surprise, however, your perception can grasp his arm. It's small and strange, too close and almost too tiny, but it's there, because at least the outermost layer of him is rock. Calcium and carbon and flecks of oxidized iron that must have once been blood and... You pause, frowning, and open your eyes. You don't remember closing them.
What is that?
What is that? The side of his mouth that hasn't been seamed by a burn lifts in a sardonic smile. You scowl. There's something in this stuff that you're becoming. This stone stuff. It's not, I don't know, it's rock and not.
Can you assess the flesh further down the arm?
You shouldn't be able to. But when you narrow your focus to the limit that you can, when you squint and press your tongue to the roof of your mouth and wrinkle your nose, it's there too. Big, sticky globules all bouncing against one another. You withdraw at once, revolted. At least stone is clean.
Look again, Cyan. Don't be a coward.
You could be annoyed, but you're too old for this shit now. Setting your jaw, you try again, taking a deep breath so you won't feel queasy.
Everything's so wet inside him, and the water isn't even sequestered away between layers of clay or...
You pause. Narrow your focus still further. Between the gelidity moving too, but in a slower and less organic way, you suddenly sense the same thing you found in the stone of him. Something else, neither flesh nor stone. Something immaterial, and yet it is there for you to perceive. It glimmers in threads strung between the bits of him, crossing itself in lattices, shifting constantly. Tension? An energy, shiny and streaming. Potential. Intention. You shake your head, pulling back so you can focus on him. What is that? This time, he answers.
The stuff of orogeny.
He makes his voice dramatic, since his facial expressions can't change much.
I've told you before that what we do isn't logical. To make the Earth move, we put something of ourselves into the system and make completely unrelated things come out. There's always been something else involved, connecting the two. This.
You frown. He sits forward, growing more animated with his excitement, just the way he used to in the old days. But then something creaks on him, and he flinches with pain. Carefully, he sits back against Antimony's hand again.
But you're hearing him, and he's right.
It hasn't ever really made sense, has it, the way orogeny works? It shouldn't work at all, that willpower and concentration and perception should shift mountains. Nothing else in the world works this way. People cannot stop avalanches by dancing well or make storms happen by refining their hearing. And on some level, you've always known that this was there, making your will manifest. This, whatever it is. Alabaster has always been able to read you like a book.
The civilization that made the obelisks has a word for this, he says,
nodding at your epiphany.
I think there's a reason we don't. It's because no one for countless generations has wanted Origins to understand what we do. They've just wanted us to do it.
You nod slowly. After Alia, I can see why no one would have wanted us to learn how to manipulate obelisks.
Rust the obelisks. They didn't want us to create something better or worse.
He takes a deep breath carefully.
We're going to stop manipulating stone now, Essen. That stuff you see in me, that's what you have to learn to control, to perceive wherever it exists. It's what the obelisks are made of, and it's how they do what they do. We have to get you to do those things, too. We have to make you a 10-ringer, at least.
At least? Just like that? Why? Alabaster, you mentioned something. Moon. Tonki doesn't have a clue what that is, and all the things you've said about causing that rift and wanting me to do something worse? Something moves at the periphery of your vision. You glance up and realize the man who's been working with Lerna is coming with a bowl in his hands. Dinner for Alabaster. You drop your voice.
I'm not, by the way, helping you make things worse. Haven't you done enough already?
Alabaster glances at the oncoming nurse, too. Watching him, Alabaster says in a low voice,
The moon is something this world used to have, Essun. An object in the sky, much closer than the stars.
He keeps switching between calling you one name and another. It's distracting.
Its loss was part of what caused the seasons.
Father Earth did not always hate life, the lorists say. He hates because he cannot forgive the loss of his only child. But then, the lorists' tales also say the obelisks are harmless.
How do you know?
But then you stop, because the man has reached you, so you sit back against a nearby cot, digesting what you've heard while he spoon-feeds Alabaster. The stuff is watery mash of some kind, and not much of it. Alabaster sits there and opens his mouth for the feeding, like a babe. His eyes stay on you throughout. It's unnerving, and finally you have to look away. Some of the things that have changed between you, you cannot bear. Finally, the man is done, and with a flat look in your direction that nevertheless conveys his opinion that you should have been the one to administer the food, he leaves. But when you straighten and open your mouth to ask more questions, Alabaster says, "I'm probably going to need to use that bedpan soon. I can't control my bowels very well anymore, but at least they're still regular." At the look on your face, he smiles with only a hint of bitterness. "I don't want you to see that any more than you want to see it. So why don't we just say you should come back later? Noon seems to work better for me, not interfering with any of my gross natural functions." That isn't fair. Well, it is, and you deserve his censure, but it's censure that should be shared. "Why did you do this to yourself?" You gesture at his arm, his ruined body. Maybe you could take it better if you understood. "The consequence of what I did. At Eumenes." He shook his head. "Something to remember, Sion, for when you make your own choices in the future. Some of them come with a terrible price, although sometimes that price is worth paying." You can't understand why he sees this horrible slow death as a price worth paying for anything, let alone for what he got out of it, which was the destruction of the world. And you still don't understand what any of it has to do with stone eaters or moons or obelisks or anything else. "Wouldn't it have been better," you cannot help saying, "to just live?" "To have come back," you cannot say. "To have made what little life he could with Cyanide again after Mayov was gone, but before she found Terimo and Jija and tried to create a lesser version of the family she'd lost. Before she became you." The answer is in the way his eyes deaden. This was the look that was on his face as you stood in a node station once, over the abused corpse of one of his sons. Maybe it's the look that was on his face when he learned of Inan's death. It's certainly what you saw in your own face after Uche's. That's when you no longer need an answer to the question. There is such a thing as too much loss. Too much has been taken from you both. Taken and taken and taken, until there's nothing left but hope. And you've given that up because it hurts too much. Until you would rather die or kill or avoid attachments altogether than lose one more thing. You think of the feeling that was in your heart as you pressed a hand over Corundum's nose and mouth. Not the thought. The thought was simple and predictable. Better to die than live a slave. But what you felt in that moment was a kind of cold, monstrous love. A determination to make sure your son's life remained the beautiful, wholesome thing that it had been up to that day, even if it meant you had to end his life early. Alabaster doesn't answer your question. You don't need him to anymore. You get up to leave so that he can at least keep his dignity in front of you, because that's really all you have left to give him. Your love and respect aren't worth much to anyone. Maybe you're still thinking of dignity when you ask one more question, so that the conversation doesn't end on a note of hopelessness. It's your way of offering an olive branch, too, and letting him know that you've decided to learn what he has to teach you. You're not interested in making the season worse or whatever he's on about, but it's clear that he needs this on some level. The son he made with you is dead. The family you built together has been rendered forever incomplete. But if nothing else, he's still your mentor. You need this too, a cynical part of you notes. It's a poor trade, really. Nasun, for him, a mother's purpose for an ex-lover's. These ridiculous mysteries for the starker and more important why of Jija murdering his own son. But without Nasun to motivate you, you need something, anything, to keep going.
So you say, with your back to him, what did they call it?
The obelisk builders. You said they had a word for the stuff in the obelisks.
The silvery stuff, thrumming between the cells of Alabaster's body, concentrating and compacting in the solidifying stone of him.
The stuff of orogeny. What was their word, since we don't have one anymore?
Oh.
He shifts, perhaps readying himself for the bedpan.
The word doesn't matter, Esun. Make one up if you like. You just need to know the stuff exists.
I want to know what they called it.
It's a small piece of the mystery he's trying to shove down your throat. You want to wrap your fingers around it, control the ingestion, at least taste some of it along the way. And two, the people who made the obelisks were powerful. Foolish, maybe, and clearly awful for inflicting the seasons upon their descendants, if they are indeed the ones who did so. But powerful. Maybe knowing the name will give you power somehow.
He starts to shake his head, winces as this causes him pain somewhere, sighs instead.
They called it magic.
It's meaningless, just a word. But maybe you can give it meaning somehow.
Magic, you repeat, memorizing.
Then you nod farewell and leave without looking back.
The Stone Eaters knew I was there. I'm certain of it. They just didn't care. I observed them for hours as they stood motionless, voices echoing out of nowhere. The language they spoke to each other was strange. Arctic, perhaps? One of the coastals? I've never heard the like. Regardless, after some 10 hours, I will admit that I fell asleep. I woke to the sound of a great crash and crunch, so loud that I thought the shattering itself was upon me. When I dared to lift my eyes, one of the Stone Eaters was scattered chunks upon the ground. The other stood as before, save for one change, directed right at me. A bright, glittering smile.
Memoir of Ooze Innovator Nat Strongback to Castries, Amateur Geomast. Not endorsed by the Fifth University. 7. Nasun finds the moon. The journey south for Nasun and her father is long and fraught. They make most of the journey with the horse cart, which means that they travel faster than Esun, who is on foot, and behind them to an increasing degree. Jija offers rides in exchange for food or supplies. This helps them move faster still because they don't need to stop and trade often. Because of this pace, they stay ahead of the worst of the changing climate, the ashfall, the carnivorous Kirkuza, and the boil bugs, and all the worst things brewing in the lands behind them. They're going so quickly when they pass through Kastrima over that Nasun barely feels Yika's summons. And when she does, it is in her dreams, drawing her down and down into the warm earth amid white crystalline light. But she dreams this 10 miles past Kastrima, since Jija thought they could go a little farther that day before camping. And thus, they do not fall prey to the honeypot of inviting whole empty buildings. When they do have to stop at comms, some are only in lockdown and haven't yet declared seasonal law. Hoping the worst of it won't come so far south, probably. It's rare for seasons to affect a whole continent at once. Nasun never speaks of what she is to strangers, but if she could, she would tell them that there is nowhere to hide from this season. Some parts of the stillness will suffer the full effects later than others, but eventually it will be bad everywhere. Some of the comms they stop at invite them to stay. Jija's older, but still hale and strong, and his napping skills and resistant use cast make him valuable.
Nasun's young enough to be trained in nearly any needed skill, and she's visibly healthy and tall for her age, already showing signs of growing into her mother's strong mid-ladder frame. There are a few places they stop, strong comms with deep stores and friendly people, where she wishes they could stay. Jija always refuses, though. He's got some destination in mind. A few of the comms they pass try to kill them. There's no logic to this, since one man and a little girl cannot possibly have enough valuables between them to be worth murdering. But there isn't much logic in a season. They run from some. Jija takes a long knife to a man's head to get them out of a comm that has let them through the gates and then tried to close them in. They lose the horses and the cart, which is probably what the comm wanted. But Jija and Nasun escape, which is what matters most. It's on foot from there and slower, but they are alive. At another comm, whose people don't even bother to warn them before aiming crossbows, it is Nasun who saves them. She does this by wrapping her arms around her father and setting her teeth in the earth, and dragging every iota of life and heat and movement out of the whole comm, until it is a gleaming, frosted confection of ice-slivered slate walls and still, solid bodies. She will never do this again, the way Jija looks at her afterward. They stay in the dead calm for a few days, resting in empty houses and replenishing their supplies. No one bothers this calm while they are there, because Nasun keeps the walls iced as a clear danger here worn off. They cannot stay long, of course. Eventually, the other comms in the area will band together and come to kill the Raga whom they will assume threatens them all. A few days of warm water and fresh food, Jija cooks one of the comms' frozen chickens for a real treat, and they move on. Before the bodies thaw and start stinking, see? And so it goes. Bandits and scammers, and a near-fatal gas waft, and a tree that fires wooden spikes when warm bodies are in proximity. They survive it all. Nasun has a growth spurt, even though she's always hungry and rarely full. By the time they finally approach the place that Jija has heard about, she is 3 inches taller, and a year has passed. They are out of the Somidlats at last, edging into the Antarctics. Nasun has begun to suspect that Jija means to take her all the way to Nife, one of the few cities in the Antarctic region near which a satellite fulcrum is said to be located. But he turns them off the Palestine-Nife Imperial Road, and they begin going eastward, stopping periodically so that Jija can consult with people along the way and see if he's going in the right direction. It is after one of these conversations, conducted always in whispers, and always after Jija thinks Nasun has gone to sleep, and only with people whom Jija considers level-headed after a few hours of chit-chat and shared food, that Nasun finally learns where they are going. "Tell me," she hears Jija whisper to a woman who was out scouting for a local calm after they have shared an evening meal of meat she caught around a fire Jija built. "Have you ever heard of the moon?" The question holds no meaning for Nasun, neither does the word at the end of it. But the woman inhales. She directs Jija to shift over to the southeast running regional road instead of the imperial road, and then to divert due south at the turning of a river they'll soon reach. Thereafter, Nasun pretends to be asleep, because she can feel the woman's narrow-eyed gaze on her. Eventually, though, Jija shyly offers to help warm her bedroll. Then Nasun has to listen while her father works to make the woman moan and gasp in repayment for the meat, and to make her forget that Nasun is there. In the morning, they move on before the woman wakes, so that she will not follow and try to hurt Nasun. Days later, they divert at the river, heading into the woods along a tree-shadowed path that is barely more than a tamped-down paler ribbon amid the forest scrub and undergrowth. The sky has not been completely shadowed for long in this part of the world. Most of the trees still have leaves, and Nasun can even hear animals leaping about and darting away as they pass. Occasionally, birds twitter or croon. There are no other people on this path, though obviously some have passed recently, or the path would be even more overgrown than it is. The Antarctics are a stark, sparsely populated part of the world, she remembers reading in the textbooks of another life. Few calms, fewer imperial roads, winters that are harsh even outside a season. The Cortents here take weeks to travel across. Swaths of the Antarctics are tundra, and the southernmost tip of the continent is said to become solid ice, which extends far into the sea. She's read that the night sky, if they could see it through the clouds, is sometimes filled with strange, dancing colored lights. In this part of the Antarctics, though, the air is almost steamy despite the light chill. Beneath their feet, Nasun can sense the heavy, pent churn of an active shield volcano, actually erupting, just very slowly, with a trickle-trickle of lava flow further south. Here and there on the topography of her awareness, Nasun can detect gas vents, and a few boils that have come to the surface as hot springs and geysers. All this moisture and the warm ground are what keep the trees green. Then the trees part, and before them looms something that Nasun has never seen before. A rock formation, she thinks, but one that seems to consist of dozens of long, columnar ribbons of brown-gray stone that ripple in an upslope, gradually slanting high enough to qualify as a low mountain or a tall hill. At the top of this river of stone, she can see bushy green tree canopies. The formation plateaus up there. Atop that plateau, Nasun can glimpse something through the trees, which might be a rounded rooftop or storecash tower, a settlement of some kind. But unless they climb along the columnar ribbons, which looks dangerous, she's not sure how to get up there. Except, it is a scratch on her awareness, rising to a pressure, itching into certainty. Nasun glances at her father, who is staring at the river of stone too. In the months since Uche's death, she has come to understand Jija better now than ever before in her life, because her life depends on it. She understands that he is fragile, despite his outward strength and stolidity. The cracks in him are new, but dangerous, like the edges of tectonic plates. Always raw, never stable, needing only the merest brush to unleash eons worth of pent-up energy and destroy everything nearby. But earthquakes are easy to manage if you know how. So Nasun says, watching him carefully, "This was made by Orogen's daddy." She has guessed that he will tense, and he does. She has guessed that he will need to take a deep breath to calm himself, which he also does. He reacts to even the thought of Orogen's the way that Mama used to react to red wine, with fast breath and shaking hands and sometimes freezing or weak knees. Daddy could never even bring things that were burgundy-colored into the house. But sometimes he would forget and do it anyway, and once it was done, there was no reasoning with Mama. Nothing to be done but wait for her shakes and rapid breathing and hand-wringing to pass. Hand-rubbing. Nasun did not notice the distinction, but Esun was rubbing one hand. The old ache, there in the bones. Once Jija is calm enough, therefore, Nasun adds, "I think only Orogen's can get up that slope, too." She's sure of this, in fact. The stone columns are moving imperceptibly. This whole region is a volcano, an exquisitely slow eruption. Here, it pushes up a steady incremental lava flow that takes years to cool, and thus separates itself into these long hexagonal shafts as the stuff contracts. It would be easy for an origin, even an untrained one, to push against that upswelling pressure, taste some of that slow-cooling heat, and raise another column. Ride it to reach that plateau. Many of the stone ribbons before them are paler, gray, fresher, sharper. Others have done this recently. Then Daddy surprises her by nodding jerkily. There should be others like you in this place. He never says the O word or the R word. It's always like you and your kind and that sort. It's why I brought you here, sweetening. Is this the Antarctic fulcrum? Maybe she was wrong about where that was. No. His lip curls. The fault line trembles. It's better. It's the first time he's ever been willing to speak of this. He's not breathing much faster either, or staring at her in that way he so often does when he's struggling to remember that she's his daughter. Nasun decides to probe a little, testing his strata. Better? Better. He looks at her, and for the first time in what feels like forever, he smiles at her the way he used to. The way a father should smile at his daughter. They can cure you, Nasun. That's what the stories say. Cure her of what? She almost asks. Then survival instinct kicks in, and she bites her tongue before she can say the stupid thing. There is only one disease that afflicts her in his eyes. Only one poison he would journey halfway across the world to have drawn out of his little girl. A cure. Cure? For orogeny? She hardly knows what to think. Be other than what she is? Be normal? Is that even possible? She's so stunned that she forgets to watch her father for a moment. When she remembers, she shivers, because he has been watching her. He nods in satisfaction at the look on her face, though. Her surprise is what he wanted to see. That, or maybe wonder, or pleasure. He would have reacted poorly to dislike or fear. How? She asks. Curiosity he can tolerate.
I don't know, but I heard about it from travelers before.
Just as there is only one your kind that he ever means, there's only one before that matters for both of them.
They say it's been around for maybe the last 5 or 10 years.
But what about the fulcrum? She shakes her head, confused. If anywhere, she would have thought. Daddy's face twists.
Trained, leashed animals are still animals.
He turns back to the rise of flowing stone.
I want my little girl back.
I haven't gone anywhere. Nasun thinks, but knows better than to say. There's no path to illustrate the way to go, no signs to indicate anything nearby. Part of that could be seasonal defenses. They've seen a few calms that protected themselves not just with walls, but seemingly insurmountable obstacles and camouflage. Doubtless the members of the calm know some secret way to get up to the plateau, but without this knowledge, Nasun and Jija are left with a puzzle to solve. There's also no easy way past the rise. They could go around it, see if there are steps on the other side, but that might take days. Nasun sits down on a log nearby, after checking it carefully for insects or other creatures that might have turned aggressive since the start of the season. Nasun has learned to treat nature and her father with the same wary caution. She watches Jija pace back and forth, pausing now and again to kick at one of the ribbons where it rises sharply from the ground. He mutters to himself. He'll need time to admit what must be done. Finally, he turns to her.
Can you do it?
She stands up. He stumbles back as if startled by the sudden movement, then stops and glowers at her. She just stands there, letting him see how much it hurts her that he fears her so. A muscle flexes in his jaw. Some of his anger fades into chagrin. Only some.
Will you have to kill this forest to do it?